Well, we'll call this informal. What do we call it? An informal
joint meeting.
Joint meeting of the supervisors and the Planning and Zoning Commission.
Yep.
I didn't really have an agenda, so we were hoping to hear what's going on with the supervisors, and also just to have an open discussion on things that we think maybe we could collaborate, or things we think maybe we might want to improve on or ask about.
Well, I'll just start. Everybody obviously knows we've got a new director. Well, we've had made a few changes over the last few months, and I'm pretty excited about Charlie's leadership, and I think he's got a little bit different idea on how things are going to go, and change is always good.
Some change is always good.
I still eat the same breakfast every morning. See, I don't like the change.
Well, you could mix that up a little bit.
The thing is, we've still got our three supervisors. Yeah. That's the great thing.
No.
Yeah. And then Ryan, he's, you know, I've had a couple long discussions, and I think Ryan's pretty happy with the way things turned out. At least I hope he is. And he's got a lot to contribute. I've been assured by everybody, including Kristen, that the workload wasn't going to be a problem with Leanne's absence. And I don't know if the three of us realized it. Maybe we did on some level, but we didn't want to admit it, that we had put so much on Leanne's plate that were outside of her director's duties for planning and zoning that I think it kind of limited her abilities down there. So I think we're probably going to be in a better position. So
change can be good, and it can be a win-win. And I think this one was absolutely a win-win. I think our planning and development department is more streamlined and headed in a great direction. And the reality is what Leanne now is doing for Story County is something that Story County desperately needed, and it fits right in Leanne's wheelhouse of her talents and her interest. And so I'm always excited when we can find a win-win, but I'm really, really excited. I've been talking to developers and builders all over the county, and they are thrilled with the attitude and responsiveness that they're getting out of our planning and development department. And I think there's a great opportunity this year for us to dig in and really start to take a look as Charlie puts his mark on the department, take a look at what we're focused on and how we're doing things in planning and development. And I'm excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot more than I could add to that. I didn't have any doubts in my mind that if this was something that Charlie wanted to aspire to do and take over the directorship of the program, that we wouldn't miss a beat, that things would just move right ahead. And then it also gives a different perspective and him an opportunity to put his own footprint in it and took a look at some areas in, where he feels that maybe we could tweak this or tweak that or make the process easier when it comes to developers and the planning process. So all in all, I think this is an exciting time. When you look at what we as a board have been able to accomplish over the last 4 years, I being a longtime member here, recognized for years that I've been pleased with Story County and our the work of our elected officials, department heads, and so forth. But I've seen a new initial focus in terms of more strategically focusing up on what it is about Story County that we could do, and we shouldn't rest on our past laurels, but look to the future and try to do things that's going to complement not only the citizens of the county, but be long range in terms of future growth and development. And I think it really starts with my two colleagues here, their vision of trying to have us take a look at some of these types of things. And we've now been able to put people in leadership positions in place that I think is certainly going to bode well for the future. And so I know I come to work now each day with a renewed sense of purpose and a certain enjoyment. And the thing that happens that you all probably don't see as much is of the current board right now, there's a tremendous level of trust that we've divided up areas of responsibility and relate and work and liaison assignments with certain staff and elected officials. And that level of trust has allowed us to be able to move the county forward in a much more positive, proactive way. And I think those are the types of things that you don't see. It's not that we always agree initially, but when something is presented and put on the table for us to really take a look at, we know that whoever's been responsible for that has done their job and have tried to vet it as best they could with the staff that's brought there, and then we can try to tweak it and move forward in a positive way. And we've so far been able to be very supportive of many of the initiatives that we're doing. I do think that Story County is at a point that when it comes to zoning, development, and things, we need to be continue proactive and look at ways that we can bridge that gap between what's good for the citizenry, what's good for the individual communities, but also is there a way that the developers can plan for growth and development based on what the market is trying to do, where it does not negatively impact the other quality of life of people that we hold in general. So all in all, I think we as a county are positioned ourselves in a very positive way, and I want to thank Charlie and staff and so forth for, you know, your ongoing efforts and things that we as a board will look forward to working collaboratively with you. And certainly I'd be remiss if we didn't mention the board here, the Planning and Zoning Commission, and your support and effort and the work that you put into helping us when it comes time to presenting something to us that we have to decide on. We know that it's been thoroughly vetted, and that is a help, too. So with that, I don't have much more to say.
And I don't know if the commissioner wants to add anything. The only thing, I'll say one thing, first of all, is through this whole transitional period that we've had over the last few months, I would not have been able to do it without Kristen and Ryan. So they also deserve a lot of accolades for this transition that we've had. And I really appreciate all everything they've done to help me kind of through this, but and help the county through this. The one kind of main point I wanted to have with this meeting was in trying to develop our work program for next calendar year, 2015. And just kind of get some ideas maybe from the board and from the commission. A lot of the stuff that we put on our work program eventually comes through the commission with recommendations to the Board of Supervisors. So at least having some initial buy-in, I think, on a lot of these potential projects would be a good thing. And I know through, you know, the last couple of years, even this last year, there's been things. For example, the commission will ask about, you know, can we do this better? Can we look into something here? You know, for example, last meeting, Mr. Wendt brought up the whole decommissioning plan that we have with wind turbines, trying to get some further education on that and looking into that with our attorney's office and making sure that what we have in our regulations is actually effective. And if we ever do need to decommission these things 30 years down the road, if we have the appropriate mechanisms to do that. It's hard for me to answer that question, obviously, with these turbines that have only been in the ground now for 6-7 years, whatever it is, and we haven't had to go through a decommissioning process on any of them yet, but we need to, I guess, be assured, you know, 30 years from now we can do that. So, the email I sent out to everybody, I kind of asked just to think of some ideas while you're driving around, if you see something through the meetings, if you've noticed something. I know from staff standpoint, I've got a small list of things here, so I can kind of start out if you want to get the discussion rolling on some of the things that we think need to be looked at. And a lot of this is, you know, been going on for a while, but kind of come to a head in the last 3 months just from some of the staff meetings we've had internally. Our work program last year, we had a few code of ordinances reviews on there that touched on bed and breakfast regulations, accessory structures and buildings, and shadow flicker. Really the only one that we have addressed so far is the shadow flicker. The Planning and Zoning Commission reviewed that last month. The Board of Supervisors will be reviewing that regulation here a week from next Tuesday. So that's where we are in those, just so the commission is aware.
So repeat that now. What was that one?
The shadow flicker, what it is, and Ryan might be able to actually, Ryan worked pretty hard on this one, so maybe I'll get him to explain it, but you're also going to hear about this on the 18th too. So, but Shadow Flicker is, I don't know, maybe Ryan can probably explain it better than okay. I am. I'm going to have him do it.
The intermittent shadow that's created from turbine blades moving.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And there's been concern brought forward in a lot of the case reviews of the conditional use permits that have been brought forward regarding shadow flicker. So what we've done is we've gone back and we did an analysis and we researched, you know, any regulations that are currently out there and, you know, best practices involved with regulating shadow flicker and kind of developed some language that we might, may be able to add to our ordinance to address that issue because it has been a concern consistently brought forward with each commercial wind energy conversion system brought forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one of those things that back in 2007 when it was coming up, there really wasn't much research on it at all. We couldn't really get a grasp of what it was. And recently with some of the new ones that we've had, there's a lot more research out there now.
Sure.
There's a lot more.
And it
more.
Can, the shadow flicker can has been shown it can cause seizures
yeah.
among some in the population. But now didn't we position all these, to date, all these commercial wind turbines that we have far enough away from residents that we don't hit shadow flicker?
One company agreed to move theirs a little bit to eliminate that situation, and those are, you know, the ones, the new ones.
Yeah. And full disclosure, Mr. Wendt was kind of the one that brought this to a spearhead because he had one, and I'll let you explain it.
But. Yeah, that turbine was 1,200 feet from our house, and it's a 500-foot-tall turbine, and that put us where they had positioned it in a $100-per-year flicker.
Huh.
And the regulations are anywhere from 15 to 20 hours per year. They try to minimize it below mm-hmm. that. And so fortunately for me, the company agreed to move the turbine 1,000 feet south and 500 feet east to minimize the flicker on the house and get it below that 15-hour-per-year limit.
And I think our current regulations only require a separation of 1,000 feet from a turbine to the closest house. Now, again, when these regulations were first drafted, I think turbines at that time were much smaller than they're getting now. They're getting bigger. It seems like every time we get another request and they're getting bigger, we're modifying current requests that we have on the table to allow for bigger, so that they're just getting bigger. And I think over time, you know, when they were first drafted, the only ones we had were the three here in Nevada, which are very small in comparison to the other ones out there. So, yeah, again, we noticed that there was something that needed to be done about it, and we're bringing that forward, and hopefully we'll get that approved.
You had bed and breakfast.
Yeah, bed and breakfast, that was something that was brought up. Just our current bed and breakfast regulations, there's two different kinds. There's a bed and breakfast inn, and there's just a regular bed and breakfast. One can be used without a conditional use permit through a home business permit. I think after, is it two bedrooms, then it goes up to a conditional use permit. And there was just some question on, can we look at that? You know, we've discussed that internally. We can carry that forward if it's necessary, but we don't have too many bed and breakfasts that we have out there. You know, we have Montebello by Ames. We used to have Onion Creek, I think, had one as well, but we haven't had much of an issue on those. I know there was a property owner to the south of town here that wanted to put up what she called a granny flat, which is kind of an accessory dwelling on a property for her mother-in-law who had an illness. And then once her mother-in-law deceased, then they wanted to turn it into a bed and breakfast. And seeing the regulations, she just didn't think that they worked out well for her. So we can look into that, but I think that ties back into the other one that I had was accessory buildings and structures. You know, currently we obviously allow for accessory structures, but one thing that really is kind of brought this to a head, I think, with staff is the push for rural broadband. There's a lot of people out there who are wanting to put antennas on their properties to be able to bring in that broadband to their property, and, you know, they're asking, well, what do I need to do to have this done? And really, we have height regulations on structures at 40 feet, which that's not going to meet any of those. And then from there, we have communication towers as a CUP. Well, I think that's a little bit extreme to require them to go through a conditional use permit process just to have an accessory tower for their house to bring in internet. So I think we really probably do need to look at our accessory structures and what we allow and what we don't want to allow. heights and stuff like that. So that's one thing I definitely would recommend us carrying forward to next year.
Is it appropriate to roll a review of our current bed and breakfast regulations into a look at that?
We probably could, yeah. And I think we can kind of look at them on top of each other, you know, because, again, with an accessory structure, could we allow a bed and breakfast in an accessory structure? Do we want to allow for accessory dwellings on properties? You know, that's kind of that's a pretty big issue because the thing I see with granny flats, and the commission can jump in here anytime, you know, granny flats are good when you're trying to cater them towards an ailing family member, but then 20 years down the road when that ailing family member is no longer there, what's happening with it? Well, a lot of times you're going to have people who are renting them out, and, you know, do you want all these out there in the county? I don't know. So I've never really looked into that and saw the effects of it. A lot of counties allow for them, and I don't know exactly how they allow for them or what mechanisms they use to approve them. So I think it's something worth looking at, yeah.
Well, so what's the proper process if we would like you guys to have that or keep it on your work program? What's the proper process?
Again, just with this discussion, what I was hoping to do was just get some ideas, put them on paper, and then present them as this is what we're going to plan on doing for our work program. So, yeah, pretty much if you verbally say, please carry that forward, we'll carry it forward. So.
Yeah, I don't know that I necessarily see the need to really go hard at the bed and breakfast, but if we can do it in conjunction with something that I think would be pretty important, which is more the accessory kind of buildings and structures, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think the idea of evaluating the accessory structures and requiring a conditional use permit, I think as far as it's related to like a residence, I think that's probably where we do want to kind of review it and say, in my opinion,
yeah,
where we would want to say, you know, what is it for and what is the use for it and what is the long term,
yeah,
designation.
Yeah, the last thing we want to do, especially with those, because I've taken one phone call. I know Ryan's taken quite a few, I think, over the last few months about those towers for broadband. The one thing I don't think we want to be telling people is you have to go through a four-month approval process to put one of those up. I just don't think that's anywhere close to where we want to be as a county. So,
In addition, there's a little inconsistency with our regulations involved with residential-type wind turbines that we added in the language for those a couple years back that allow for 150-foot turbine in a residential area, but we don't have currently language in our regulations that would allow for these towers through an administrative process without public review.
What would happen if I had one of the wind turbines that you allow me to go 150 feet and I want to put an antenna up there on it? Can I do that now? All right, so that's good enough for me.
That would be up to the director's discretion.
Yeah, I think we'd allow for that. I don't know if it would be too possible to do something like that from an engineering standpoint, but I see it as a power.
But I think that's where there's an opportunity for revision, right? If we allow one and then we would say, yeah, we'd probably allow you to put an antenna on it if you already had the wind turbine, and you don't have to go through this process if it's a wind turbine, then...
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Leanne's starting to look into that Connect Iowa thing again and really get the ball rolling on that. And I think that's probably somewhere where we can maybe work a little bit in conjunction with her because, again, I think with the push for rural broadband that Governor Branstad's going to be, I'm assuming, going to be making here with the next few legislative seasons, that we're probably going to see an increased demand on these things. So just an example of some stuff that we've seen. Quickly, the other few things that we have on here, we had a review of our fine schedule. That's something internally that we need to do. Our fines, sometimes people argue they're not adequate enough, but we just need to kind of talk with Jessica Reynolds and see what we can do and can't do as far as fines. That's something that's relatively simple. The big thing that we've had, and this is a carryover now for 2 years, is that zoning map audit and the Ames Fringe Plan audit. The Ames Urban Fringe Plan audit is something that we really have to work in conjunction with the City of Ames, and they're kind of dragging their feet on it a little bit. They've had some staff changes recently, too, and they're trying to kind of get their feet wet on the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. City of Ames is looking at that East Annexation area. There's some other areas down by in the ISU Research Park that they're making some changes to. So I know that everybody knows that the Ames Urban Fringe Plan really needs to be looked at. We just need to all sit down and figure out a timeline on that. But until we do that, that zoning map audit I don't think can be done. And even more so with the zoning map audit, if the county is going to be getting serious here soon about a comprehensive plan with a comprehensive land use component to it, we kind of need to wait for that before we really do the zoning map audit, because the zoning districts that we have on our zoning map need to match what we have in our land use plan. Mm-hmm. So we'll keep that on the work program, but just know kind of the underlying effect on that is we have to wait kind of until we have those other balls rolling. So
could I ask what you mean by audit? Are you saying like a review or what
exactly
happens?
For example, for our zoning map, and we've noted this for a while, we have some zoning districts out there where the Ames Urban Fringe Plan says that we want to have 1 acre lot sizes or bigger, but the zoning districts have a minimum lot size requirement of 25,000 square feet. So the two don't.
They
don't agree with each other, and we want to look
so
at
who's
that.
Doing that audit?
The audit, that would be probably internally by us, unless for whatever reason we found it to be too cumbersome, and then maybe we could, through our comprehensive plan, maybe we could work on some elements of that to maybe have.
But the first domino that has to, that makes sense to go is a full look at the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, and then do this as part of that or in conjunction with that, and we aren't driving the bus on that. City of Ames is driving the bus on when we're going to.
Yeah, so given that, based on past experience and working with the Ames Urban Fringe Plan, expect this to be on our work program for a couple of years now.
Yeah, well, but Ames is starting to dig into their land use plan right now, which is going to trigger more work on the Ames Urban Fringe Plan. And there's a couple items sitting out there that's going to necessitate a full look at this Ames Urban Fringe Plan. I just think it's important that you have it on your work program, but noted that a couple other things have to take place before you dig into it.
That's what I was getting at. Quickly kind of go through my comments here then. One other thing that we noted is we need to also look at adding something in our ordinance that deals with small animals in our R1, R2, AR zoning districts. Currently, agricultural exemption kind of carries a lot of weight there, where we say, well, it's agricultural use. If you have chickens in your yard, for example, that's an agricultural use. We can't control that. But I think adding something in our ordinance to say that, and again, I don't know how the commission feels about this. I don't know how the board feels about this. If we want to have something like that in our ordinance to say, yes, we do allow for this, or no, we don't allow for this. We've had issues. We had an issue up in Skycrest subdivision where a lady had a rooster out in her yard that was waking up the entire neighborhood at 4 o'clock in the morning that we had to deal with. And then finally we passed it off to Sue McCaskey in Animal Control, and she got it taken care of right away, which was great. So, but again, just having something in our ordinance that talks about small animals and what type of small animals we want to allow in our residential zoning districts. Obviously, I don't think we want to allow for cows and cattle and all that stuff, but, you know, small animals, chickens, stuff like that, what's the effect of that? So something that we want, just noted that we wanted to look at. Now that the election's over, we need to start looking internally, too, on our annexation process and some of our subdivision processes. I was really kind of waiting to bring this forward until we knew who the recorder was going to be, because now working with Stacy, for example, we need to work with her really closely to figure out what we're doing. Annexations have become somewhat of a problem internally, as the way that they're handled currently, they get recorded, they get passed up to the auditor's office, and that's really it. Well, then we have, from our standpoint, a lot of addressing issues that need to be taken care of. Connie Hambly with the 911 board is running into issues all over the place because they're not getting taken care of, because a lot of times she's not even aware an annexation took place. So we've got to figure out some internal process on that, and I know I've got buy-in at least from most of the people involved in that. We're going to look at that subdivision process, mainly on legal descriptions and recording of various legal documents. We have to have a better process in place on that. Currently, the board signs a resolution. However, that resolution goes with the subdivision plat and then six other legal documents. And a lot of times what's happening is those legal documents don't have consistent legal descriptions on them, and that's becoming an issue. So, again, something internally that we need to figure out, and how we can better assure that these things are just getting recorded once and we're not having to go back and amend resolutions and other recorded documents. Ordinance number one, that's been an issue for a long time now with our department. Ordinance number one talks about how, especially with the Board of Supervisors, how we publish for legal or for public hearings. Currently, ordinance number one states that if there's a public hearing in front of the Board of Supervisors, we have to publish notice in a paper 15 days prior to that first consideration. That's why you reviewed, the commission reviewed the sign regulations and the shadow flicker back in early November, back in early October, but the Board of Supervisors won't be reviewing this now until November 18th. Well, we did have Veterans Day in there too, but still, by the time we're done with the commission meeting, we get the notification off to the paper publishes it, and then we start that 15-day clock. We're looking now at almost a month and a half before the board can review it. So I've talked with Jessica Reynolds again in the county attorney's office about matching that more with state code, because what happens is that ordinance number one is written off a state code version from 1973, which has been amended to lessen the amount of time that you need to publish. So
what does state code say right now?
No more than four, nor or no less than four, no more than 20 days.
I would say work with Jessica and get something. Yep. Does that have to go through planning and zoning? Or
probably not.
That,
no, I think that's just a...
I'd say get that to us prior to January 1st when we can do things like... Are we going to talk about publications this year? Our official publications? We've been wanting to for a couple
we
years.
Probably we probably should.
Yeah, that's something we have to go through.
It's too onerous right now. With online and everything else, we need to make this as streamlined as we can to get to a decision.
And internally, we've changed some of our public hearing processes and stuff, and I think explained this to everybody here, but that's our feeling, too, is that when you have to put publication in a paper, that's not as effective as the other ways that we're doing it. It costs way too much money. It costs a lot of money. I mean, Kristen, you can comment on this, but I think in the past we were spending almost $300 to $500 a month on legal publications.
Well, this is not just an issue for us. This is a statewide issue, and this is something that ISAC and has been talking about and looking at. And right now, we're not getting really enough support from the legislature or anyone that would say that they really want to delve in this. Obviously, the Newspaper Association is an awful strong lobbyist group. And they're in it to make money. Yes. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And they use it as a disguise to say, well, it's all about public information and getting the information out so everybody knows it. But we also know that more and more people are not using that medium as the source of information anymore. And so we're trying to get the laws changed where, you know, we can begin to use more of the electronic posting and different types of media rather than the actual newspaper, and we're running into just resistance after resistance with that. So I do think that that's issue is really going to be whether or not we can get some support from the state in making those changes. We can talk about it at the local level, but I'm not sure that's going to be enough of a carrot for us to make the change we need.
Wayne, I think you're right, but we don't, here in Story County right now, we have three official newspapers. We don't have to have three.
Well, we don't have to have three.
We need to follow state law, but we don't need to make it more onerous on somebody to get through a normal process than it than state law tells us it needs to be. So I would ask that you work with Jessica and you get something on the Board of Supervisors agenda as soon as possible, but definitely before the 1st of January when we do our organizational meeting, because this is something that we need to... Ready to talk through before
and,
that.
And part of the problem, two of those three publications only publish once a week.
Yeah,
so
yeah, that's the problem.
They've got a Thursday deadline, you know, for the following week, and then our deadline's on Thursday. So a lot of times you have to give notice to the paper 2 weeks before it's ever going to appear in the paper. So,
and also one of the things that we have to do, I think, is just looking at the calendar and say we have to publish on this date so we can have a meeting on this date, and it's too much work for us almost even. So. Last thing that I have I just wrote this down a couple days ago as I had another call on it, but looking at some sort of special event or one-day event type permits. I had somebody just call a few days ago asking what they needed to do because they wanted to have a wedding on their farm. Right now we do have a conditional use permit process that would handle kind of a special event. But again, for an event like that, do we want to make them go through a conditional use permit process? When RAGBRAI came through a few years ago, we had vendors calling us left and right asking, you know, what do I need to do with zoning on this? And we didn't have anything in place, so we kind of just let it go, knowing that it was going to be looked at really hard. But, again, I think it's probably time just to see what other counties do, see how they handle those special one-day events. you know, a lot of those small events, I don't know if it's worth bringing them through, again, a four-month approval process just for that one-day event. If there's something that we can do administratively, I don't know. I don't know what other counties do, but I think, again, just us researching that issue would be worthwhile. So,
but I think your comment with, you know, for these kinds of small events, I think you have to be able to identify kind of some sort of a size or an impact, right?
Yeah.
It might not be a lot of people, but it might be a lot of traffic,
yep.
Right? Like Ragbri obviously has an impact wherever it goes through. And so I just think that we'd have to make sure and be able to identify the, I don't know whether it's size or traffic or, you know, some way quantify what it is that you can approve on a come in and fill out a form and, you know, pay a fee,
yeah,
or whatever and get your 1 day pass versus, you know, we're going to have 1,000 cars show up at a farm for a, you know, a big,
mm-hmm,
it's only 1 day, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and for me, there's a line out there as to whether it's a commercial endeavor or it's a personal endeavor.
Right.
If,
yeah,
Paul Toot has a wedding, which you're going to have here one day down the road when Margaret gets going, you know, and he has 500 people on his property, that's different. Nancy, when you have somebody out at something going on out at your place and it's a one-day deal, but it's not a commercial endeavor, that's different to me than vendors who are coming wanting to set up shop because Ragbri's going through.
Right.
And so maybe there's different triggers.
Size and a commercial.
Something.
Yeah.
I think it's worth looking at.
Yeah. And it might not even be an issue, too. Again, I haven't heard any complaints on this or through the years. I don't know if the sheriff's office has dealt with anything that we need to look at. I don't know. But, again, at least opening that discussion and seeing if there is anything there. So. I don't know if Ryan and Kristen have anything to add at this point from staff standpoint. I think I kind of outlined this from the discussions that we've had. So I guess I'll kind of turn it back over to the commission and the board and see if there's anything else out there that you guys feel that we should look at in this next coming year.
Well, I've got a couple, and we'll see if it spurs conversation.
Sure.
Okay. How old, you mentioned E911 working with them. How old is our signage in E911? Have we got signage that's old enough that we're going to need to be thinking about replacement? You mentioned it more from a making sure we don't have to go through 8 steps in order to get done. I'm just thinking we've got enough E911 signage out there that's got to be getting of an age where we need to be thinking about it. Where does that reside, and is it you guys? You know?
Yeah, the signage usually goes through us. We deal with assigning the address and spurring the work order on the address. Then what happens is we give it off to Secondary Roads. Secondary Roads will make the sign and post the sign, do all the on call locates and everything on it. I think we first adopted our addressing ordinance, don't quote me on this, but I want to say it was 94 or 95, and that is probably about how old most of those signs are out there. I don't know what the lifespan is on them going through.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I know every so often you'll see some that look to be a little bit worn and tattered. I think a lot of that has to do with people that do ditch burning, and they more or less melt the numbers off them. We deal with, especially in the wintertime, a lot of times secondary roads, plows will take some of them out and we'll have to replace them. But for the most part, if I'm ever out driving around, if I see one missing, we'll follow up on it, figure out what we need to do, get it taken care of. But, you know, yeah, I don't know what the expected lifetime or lifespan on those signs is. I don't necessarily notice too much. It's hard to say, too, because I don't drive around at night, so I don't know how the reflectivity and everything on them is working. I think the engineer's office has to go through and look at their signs annually and see that. And I know in the past, Leanne's kind of asked, when you do that, just take a look at the E911 signs and let us know if you think they need to be updated. But probably a worthwhile discussion, and if we have to start doing that, how we're going to pay for that and all that, because that could be a pretty expensive. I think those signs cost $30 a piece for the engineer's office, if I remember. It's either $30 or $35. But, yeah, when you take that by how many houses we have out there, that could be expensive.
Yeah, well, for me, most of them are 20 years old, even the ones that are in good shape are going to start showing some age at some point. I think we just need a mechanism for how we get new ones out there, short of one of you guys happen to drive by, mm-hmm, and see that it's done. So if that's something that wouldn't take much time to look at, I'd like to look at that. So when we moved Leanne and restructured, one of the things that we kept with her, and I don't think we ever said we were keeping it with her permanently, but she's the only one certified to do it right now, is floodplain management. Does that belong with planning and development? Does it belong somewhere else? I don't think it necessarily belongs with the position Leanne currently has. She's just the one doing it. I'd like to look at where that belongs, and if it belongs with you guys, we got to go down the road of getting one of you certified.
Yeah, and I know there's not too many. I mean, Leanne being certified in floodplain management is a pretty unique thing, I think, when you look at the overall spectrum of the state. I don't know too many people, too many other counties who deal with floodplain who have certified floodplain managers, and I think that was kind of the reasoning that the floodplain stayed with Leanne, is because she has that expertise in floodplain. But if you look at other counties, pretty much every county's planning and development, planning department, whatever it may be, the zoning department deals with floodplains. So is it appropriate to be in our department? Possibly, yes. But again, I guess my feeling on it is you have that floodplain expert in the county who's not no longer in our department. So I don't know the best way to handle that. She's, again, Leanne's the expert, and she's really good at that stuff, so I'd hate to take her completely away from it, but I know she's going to have a lot of responsibilities coming up, and where it's appropriately held, I don't know. That's probably a discussion more for the board to have, but can we look into it? Yeah, and it's not that we're necessarily experts at floodplain, but we definitely have enough background on it, I think, to where we can maybe review the minor things, but it's when we get into the pretty technical aspects of our floodplain regulations that it's probably going to be a little bit more difficult for one of us to look at it without further training.
And I think it might be an engineer question to have with the engineer and see how much of it he would think would be appropriate in his department.
Yeah,
I mean he's an engineer. His assistant is an engineer, and I know they've. They're in the process of hiring. I can't remember what position it is that they're looking at now. But that may be something that would worth a discussion with the engineer to see how much of that he thinks is appropriate with his department. Because he deals with it, really the same as you guys do.
We probably get half of our permits a year from the engineer's office. So
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'd just like to have the conversation. A couple years ago, we did a pilot program where we provided services to our smaller communities. We did it. It went away. I don't remember that we ever got a report back on it or any recommendations of where it was going. I'd just like to see some kind of follow-up, and I'm not suggesting that with current staffing levels we'd want to be doing that. But is it something that's appropriate for the county long-term to look at offering? I'd like to close the circle on that one. It feels like we went and did it for, was it a year or was it 6 months? How long did we do it?
No, it was three or four months.
Yeah. 3 or 4 months. Yeah. I'd just like to close the circle on that and see where we were. And along those lines, or I guess related to that, this board's been working really, really hard, and I assume will continue to work really hard at providing economic development opportunities to our smaller communities. But we've left out Fernald. We've left out, I mean, who else is out there? Shipley and Iowa Center. And I mean, we've left some of those out. And what I don't know is who's the appropriate representative to see if there are opportunities to assist, those villages, if you will, in Story County.
Well, we did have a longtime resident from Fernald come in here a month or so ago with some concerns. And there's... And I just drove through there the other day. There's probably three or four houses that are mainly east of the four-way stop sign in Fernald that are, not suitable for habitation. They probably need to come down. And I know that Leanne's had some conversation with one of the Richland Township trustees. They would like to put some sort of a shelter. They've got a park there at the Four Corners. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really just a basketball court. But they would like to put up some sort of a shelter because there's, I think there's four or five kids that get on a school bus up there every day, and they would like, the possibility of putting some sort of a shelter up there. But, I think that, and when I first started on the board, I got some calls from people that said that, they seal-coated the streets up here years ago, but they haven't done anything to them with them since. And we did get them seal-coated again here a couple of years ago. But, I mean, we can't forget them. It's not unincorporated, so now it's our responsibility.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
And I know Margaret's had quite a few problems with some stuff in Fernald too, and we had, I know that that citizen came forward, and the at that time I think Rick, you said that we need to just have, I think it was Darren, me, Margaret, Leanne, and everybody just kind of get together and figure that out, and that might be an appropriate time to start looking at that, because yeah, Fernald, I mean, Fernald's really kind of our only town that we have, I think, that we regulate, and we've got some, I don't think too many zoning issues in there necessarily. I think all the zoning's in place. I don't know from a junk standpoint, we used to, there, who was it, Gus Ivory, I think, that lived up there, that used to be a huge problem, but I know Sheena, when she was here, dealt with a lot of his inheritors that really kind of cleaned that up, and that's been improved greatly. So yeah, it's something that we probably should and can look at. So
okay, and now I got two big ones and one little one. The first big one is mobile home parks, specifically two that I think we need to be at least make as easy as possible for them to go away on one end all the way up to facilitating and encouraging them to go away on the other end, and what you guys' role in helping the board down that road is. Nothing easy about it, but it's something that we've got to look at. I mean, we got issues. I think you guys are well versed in it.
I think what you're referring to is when they are no longer inhabitable. Did I talk about just eliminating the mobile
park? I'm talking about eliminating two mobile home parks over time and making it easy to get rid of them. We've got, what are those two? Or like, what's the names of them?
Well, one of them is Crestview Mobile Home Courts, clear on the west, just west
right
side of Ames.
Boone Line.
On Lincoln Way, right before you go into Boone County, it's on the north side of the road.
This is not part of Ames.
No.
Not part of Ames. No. Open sewage run. I mean, it is.
The complaints we get would make you throw up.
It is.
Really?
It is awful.
Yeah.
And then one up on 190th, what's that one called?
Hickory Grove.
Yeah.
But it's not the. It's not associated
with right. Hickory Grove Mobile Home Park.
And it's not as bad as Crestview, but
no.
It's bad.
Is that the one right at Grand? Right at
it's right at Dayton.
This one's
right
at Dayton. 29 and Dayton Road.
At the stop sign out to 35.
Okay, I know where you're talking about.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I've actually been working with the ground owner, I guess the park owner of the one up there. He's wanting to junk some of these that are not in good shape. I think he'd like to get all the way back out of it. But right now we hinder. So generally when somebody abandons a mobile home, there's all kinds of unpaid taxes. You know, there's all kinds of problems. And right now it's a really tall hurdle for somebody to be able to junk it, take it out of commission, get rid of it. And so, Charlie, I don't know if this resides through you guys to take a look at ways that we can, like I say, on one hand, make it as easy as possible to close these things down. On the other hand, really encourage these things to close down.
I had put something together a few months ago. We had a meeting with, and Paul was there, but we had a meeting with the attorney's office, the treasurer's office, and that mainly dealt around the title issue
the
on
title
a lot
issue.
Of those trailers out there that we had no idea who owned them. Back taxes were way delinquent on a lot of them. Mainly, I put a memo together real quick that just outlined that, in my opinion, these trailer parks are what you consider legally established non-conforming uses. Those those mobile home parks were put in place before we had zoning. We have zoning now that has a zoning district for mobile home parks. My opinion is the second you take out an old mobile home and replace it with a new mobile home, or you start adding mobile homes, at that point it's no longer running as a legally established nonconforming use. It's just straight nonconforming. You take away that legally established nonconforming use component when you're adding trailers, when you're adding lots for these trailers. Crestview's one, I know kind of some of the determination on that was there was a mobile home park inside the city of Ames on Lincoln Swing that they vacated, and they took a lot of those mobile homes and took them out to Crestview. And that was where I was saying we're starting to add more mobile homes out there than we've ever had before. I think it's time to get in and start working
right.
The enforcement process on it. And, I guess I'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
I don't know. As far as facilitating them out of there, I don't know if the enforcement process will in itself do that. because when they look at what they're going to have to do to bring these up to zoning, I don't know if it's going to be financially feasible for those mobile home parks to continue having them out there. But then I also don't know the legalities of ending the leases and moving these people and finding new places for them to live, because that's one thing that we definitely need to touch on is if we're going to close down these mobile home parks, where are these people going to go? We need to offer, I think we need to offer some low-income housing if it's a different trailer park somewhere or what we're going to do.
And we did that several years ago with the one that was south of the old drive-in theater, which is just not far from where this current one is. But the owner didn't have the money to bring the sewage septic system up to snuff, so they went through the process of closing the court, and Leanne was heavily involved in that.
Oh, Leanne and the attorney's office.
They got a grant to get rid of a lot of them. And that's the other thing. If you're going to junk one of these mobile homes out, it has to go over to the landfill in Boone, and it can cost you $1,000 to get rid of one of them. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing in them of any value. By the time you take a 50-year-old mobile home, chances are you'd never get it to the landfill in Boone on its own. You'd have to tear it apart and truck it over there. So,
yeah, but and I'm with you on we've got to have affordable options for people to live. But I'm telling you, the people that are living in Crestview right now, I don't care if it's affordable, it's inhumane.
Right.
So to me, we've got to dig in and make it really, really hard for the owners of these places to not do it the right way, and then if they want to do it the right way, we need to figure out a way to assist them do it the right way. And if the right way is closing the dang thing down, then let's assist them in closing it down, and then let's don't get in this situation again.
Right.
But I think those are our last two that were early enough. Aren't our other mobile home parks?
Trying to think,
more
we have one. It's funny. We have Country Estates by Hickory Grove, and then Hickory Grove by Country Estates.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember that one. But yeah. The one out by Hickory Park, or not Hickory Park, Hickory Grove. I have honestly never been through that one. I don't think, but I don't think that one's bad. The other one on 190th across the street from the Moose Lodge down there. That one's pretty nice, honestly.
Right.
And then Rolling Hills. Rolling Hills has improved immensely since I've been here. The new owners of Rolling Hills have done a pretty good job of keeping that one relatively clean. And Rolling Hills also has a lot of vacant lots down there too. So that's something.
Space.
Yeah, that's something we could talk to them about, even allowing some of these people maybe to move down there. I don't know if they want to move into that location or not. But gosh, I think those are the only other three that we have in the unincorporated area, at least that I can think of off the top of my head.
I would think part of this process would be, you mentioned the difficulties in understanding the taxation issues and the legality of the title and whatnot like that, might be facilitating that process to help them, let's get clear the deadwood out, might be a big part of, kind of getting them started, at least getting the ball rolling as far as the owners would be concerned, right? Help them clean that out then.
Yeah. And health department has gone out there, and I can't remember how many notices of violation. Chris, do you remember how many Margaret left with the owner out there? Was it three or four? Yeah. So he had three or four pretty major violations that he has till the first of the year to correct. And we'll see what happens after that. So,
okay. Second one is you actually just mentioned it. It's in conjunction with this a little bit. So Boone is our construction waste landfill, right? Everything goes over to Boone. Is it time for Story County? And I'm not talking about a full fledged landfill. I'm talking about construction waste landfill to start to identify possible locations for something like that. And if so, would that start with you?
Yeah, that's a zoning issue, definitely.
We remember.
You've got to find that.
You remember a few years ago when there was some discussion about right off of the 30, right? I call it from the Cornerstone Church and the road that goes back south from there, and we were kind of talking about that area, and we got a lot of flack from a possible location.
That'll bring out the NIMBYs like crazy.
Would you want to do that? Is Boone full, or it's cost prohibitive to go that far, or what? Why would you want to do that?
Boone is really, really restrictive. They're expensive. They hold all the cards right now. So where this comes from, Nancy, for me, in my hat as chair of the Emergency Management Commission, we're looking at plans of what would we do in case of a disaster that really created a lot of construction debris. And there's not a good answer for us here in Story County. We are second or third on everybody's list of getting this done. It's going to be ultra expensive to our communities. And so it raises the question through emergency management with all the mayors of, is it time for us to look at something like this in Story County where we're at the top of the list for getting these things done? I don't know if it is or not. I just don't even know what the process would be to even take a look at it.
And I don't know, I'm not going to get too far into this, the whole management of it and all that stuff, and securing the land is obviously going to be the number one issue, but then coming forward from the zoning aspect and getting it put in place, I think we have it as part of a conditional use permit process. I'm just going to double-check that, so if you want to continue to talk while I do, feel free. But
yeah, the next one is more fun than that one, and that is that gravel pit that Manatz has at the corner, southwest corner of I-35 and 30, somewhere down the road, be it 10 years, whenever, it's going to play out. We're going to have something sitting there, and I'm a believer that we ought to work with Ames to start moving down the road of securing that when Manatz is done with it for a second Ada Hayden kind of entrance to the center of Story County, entrance to Ames. I think it's going to be more of an Ames issue, but right now that resides fully in the county, even though it's well within the two-mile urban fringe, and I'd just like us to be a step ahead of the game. I'd like us to be having conversations ultimately of what that looks like, how that's going to relate to the trail system that's in Story County and Ames.
It's pretty close to like the Hunziker Park with
right.
the dog park and
yeah.
the
yeah.
field.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. It's yeah. further down. It's further right down, at the corner yeah. of 35. Right.
No,
and
I know where you're talking,
but it's still within a close proximity.
Not far from there.
Like a big right. difference. Well, you speaking of that, just like remember the old gas station that used to be right there. I mean, that right now is just a truck parking, and it's not really what I call operating trucks. It's just really a wayside type of thing,
storage.
You know, storage.
That's Story County yeah. or is that Ames?
That's Ames.
Well, Ames, the truck Ames. Stop is Ames, but Ames stops right there at the truck stop,
right
and
there.
South of there is still Story County.
Pretty much, there's a road that goes behind the truck stop. Between all the land between that road and the highway is Ames. Everything else is Story County.
Okay.
So they annexed that, not, well, the truck stop's always been in Ames. They annexed a piece just to the east of there, not too terribly long ago, where that there used to be kind of a car sales lot there, I think. I don't know. There's a building there that's still standing there.
There used to be another gas station there.
Was there? Okay.
Yep.
And we've got floodplain issues and everything down there, too. But, yeah, that's...
Yeah, well, for me, what it comes down to is you don't hear people anymore. I'm sure there's still people out there who don't appreciate Ada Hayden, but you don't hear people anymore griping about Ada Hayden. But that was never intended to be Ada Hayden. I mean, somebody at the last minute thought, boy, that'd be great to – that's a better public use than just building houses all the way around that thing. And thank goodness they got it done from my perspective. But wouldn't it be great if they had started that process many years before and not had to do what they did? And so I want to make sure that we're at least playing our role in looking at what this can be when Manatz is done with it. I think it's a perfect place for a nice public area. And
if there would be a way to somehow bridge the connection between like the Hunziker fields and things to that. I don't know. I'd have to look at it geographically. I don't know how far it is.
Well, you're going to see
connect
off topic for us. I think Charlie and Lexi coming is on topic for us is there's the beginnings of a full trail plan for Story County, tying it into all our greenways and really starting to take advantage of all the good things that are going on with the High Trestle Trail. But what triggered is at a meeting yesterday morning where we were looking at all of this, and when you look at the aerial views and you look at what this ultimate trail system might look like, that's a really natural place as a hub and a tie-in to go through. And so I just knew we were having this meeting, so I wanted to be sure we talked about it a little bit.
I know there's a conditional use permit on that, and I believe that goes through like 2040.
Yep.
That's been out now for 1985-ish, maybe even before that. So back in those years, back some 30 years ago, they thought obviously they were going to be out there for however long. And I don't know if that's changed, but we could at least start those discussions.
Well, it's a bigger site than Ada Hayden ever thought it'd be. I mean, it is, it's going to end up being a monster.
And I don't know how much further south they want to keep pushing, because I know their initial conditional use permit just had kind of a brief quarter section in there, and they've slowly pushed it to the south and getting more land. Mm-hmm. I don't know how far down they want to go, though. So, yeah, probably worth a discussion, I would say. And real quick on the demolitions, we do have a construction and demolition landfill in our conditional use permit, so we would be involved, I think, just in making sure the zoning was in place. But there's a lot more to it than that, and I definitely would be glad to be involved in that, but the land acquisition and all that stuff.
Well, I think that's a board issue. I just think it might be good for you to bring it forward as a discussion item for the board, and maybe the three of us will decide, no, that's not even worth looking at. I just think it's a conversation worth having. Bring Keith Morgan in and talk to him about what it looks like from an emergency management point of view, and just see where we are, and if we want to pursue it any further. And then the final thing I had is, let's just continue to get more and more availability of feedback online from the residents of Story County. You guys are doing a great job with that, but everything we do, I think we need to continue to utilize that however we can.
Well, I was hoping our commissioners could all have an opportunity to ask any questions of the supervisors or bring up a topic that you thought, you know, maybe would help if we could talk about. So should we start on this end?
No pressure. I'll go first.
Yeah.
I guess the question I have is really kind of looking for feedback from the recommendations the recommendations that we make that we send to the board for approvals or things. Is there anything that is out of line, is different, that you'd like to see differently handled? We act as a group and we put together the recommendations and then we send them off and we just release them into the wind. Don't really know what happens.
I can only recall that in my 14 years, I can only recall maybe two times that maybe we have remanded something back to the commission for just some additional information and some more input. Normally, after you've gone through the process and had all the input from the public that shows up to those meetings and voices their concerns, it's been thoroughly vetted to the point that we've not found it to be inconsistent with the policies and plans that we have in place. It's only where you are going to talk about making an exception, and that's usually something that's certainly clearly been looked at, and we don't have a lot of those. I don't see anything out of order right now that I could put my finger on that would say that we're not getting the information we need.
I can't think of a time, Wayne, that we have not, and Charlie, maybe you can help me with this, I can't think of a time that we've seen a recommendation from Planning and Zoning that we didn't take it. I'm talking about the three of us over the last 4 years.
Right, that's what I'm saying. It's,
I think you guys did a great job.
14-year span.
I turned the question back to you because I was always surprised, and Charlie, you and I haven't had a chance to talk about this, so I apologize if I put you on the spot here. I was always surprised that our previous director's stance was that staff did not make recommendations to you guys. And it didn't quite make sense to me that we wouldn't have our professional staff, not that you guys would necessarily go with it, but that we wouldn't have our professional staff make at least a recommendation of this is what we see to you guys for you to deal with, and then ultimately make a recommendation to us. Like I say, I'm sorry if I'm putting you on the spot.
You brought it up before, actually.
Okay, good. I like when I bring it up at least before I throw you out there to the wolves. I would prefer to see our professional staff make some kind of recommendations to you guys for you to deal, either take them or not. And I just want to get your feelings on that. I'm really happy with what you give us. I'd just like you maybe to have a little more as you're making your decisions.
It seems to me that maybe they don't need to make their opinions known up front, but if we would ask them, do you have an opinion or which way would you like to see this go, then it seems to me like they should tell us, or should be free to tell us. Maybe they don't have an opinion. Maybe they think it could go either way. That'd be fine, too. But it seems to me like if we would ask for their opinion, then it would be nice if they could tell us what they think. Sometimes we just get kind of bogged down, and they can see it much clearer.
Mm-hmm. I'm the newest member here, so maybe I was just looking for more. Sometimes it's unclear to me. I think we're all, through our discussions, I think we usually come to a very good consensus and the important parts come out. But I think that making sure that we are aligned with kind of the vision for the county or the vision for, what we're doing with planning and zoning is good. And I think many of you have been here longer and much more engaged and involved in the process than I have been in my year. But
help me understand, though, isn't staff input is always given if you look at the minutes and the finding? The only thing that's coming from the recommendation is really coming from the commission, and staff is not referenced as making the recommendation. And that's the only change that I've seen.
The wordology.
Yeah.
That's all it is.
Right. You know. And
do you think you're already getting it?
Well, see, the presentations that we get, and I have lauded these guys numerous times, and they know that. The recommendation presentation that we get from staff is excellent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't remember maybe two or three times that we really had significant questions for them that we didn't feel that you'd cross a T or dotted an I. Okay, and so the present they cover it all, and we don't just get the paperwork. Mm-hmm. They do a presentation to us to cover all of those details that are in the paperwork, but also they're able to, in a roundabout way, give us their opinion.
If that's good enough, that's good enough. I just
I'm not unhappy with it.
Okay.
You know, I don't know that in the recommendation from the Planning and Zoning Commission that it needs to have the words that P&Z staff recommends. I don't know that wordology needs to change.
Okay.
You know, as long as we're getting the information and be able to digest it and come out with, hey, this is where it's at. And but also in terms of vision, I don't think that's really been our function to look at how things work in connection with the vision for the county. We're kind of a nuts and bolts commission. You know, it's like, here's the rules. Okay, if we want to suggest changing the rules, that's one thing. But here's the rules, and here's what we have to follow. And say yay or nay.
I don't know if there's a legal justification for not giving an official recommendation in the staff report, but to me, I often feel like you're dancing around the recommendation anyway. That if you're going to hint at it all the way through the staff report, then you might as well go all out, put it on the line, and say, this is our expert opinion. We trust you to be objective in analyzing the issue at hand. And the problem with that is that there's going to be some point down the road where the commission disagrees with your recommendation, and then you're passing along two different recommendations to the Board of Supervisors.
No, we'd have to come to a consensus with staff.
I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I think there may be a time
I
when
think there is,
the staff's opinion.
I can remember in the past that has happened at least twice.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's not uncommon.
I mean, then the staff just needs to say forward to the Board of Supervisors, this is the commission's recommendation, our recommendation with this.
Right.
That makes it harder for you
right.
to come out looking okay.
Right. But it's happened twice. That
but
I didn't
sometimes
yeah.
it needs to happen even if somebody looks bad. So I don't think there's any problem. I think, in fact, the idea of consensus building as a body here, I think, is overrated. I think that... it's nice, and it's great that when we all share different opinions.
Yeah. We don't always agree.
Right.
I mean, we don't always reach unanimous decisions.
But there's a great deal to be learned from hearing other people's comments, too. So I agree with to that extent. But, you know, I think it's okay for there to be disagreement. I think it's okay for us to disagree with the staff and from the Board of Supervisors as well. So, right. So I think...
I can remember a number of times, though, that I said... Well, what do you think? I mean, right in the meeting. Well, what do you think? And you've come forward and given me the alternative ways to look at it.
Yeah. And I'm sure everybody's probably aware of this, but I know the reason that Leanne, Aaron, obviously you were a planner here at one point, and I think you were probably on a staff that gave recommendations, if I remember right. Mm-hmm. There was a point, and it was right about when I started, that I think Leanne stated that she was hearing a lot of feedback from the public of, you guys give recommendations and the commission just adopts them. So, you know, what's the point of going to the commission when it's just you guys saying approve this and then they say, okay, we'll approve it and move it on. It's really not how it actually goes, but I think the public perception was there. So that was why Leanne thought maybe we should go away from recommendations. I talk to a lot of people in a lot of other jurisdictions and they're almost shocked when I tell them we don't give recommendations. Pretty much every single jurisdiction gives recommendations. We're one of the very few that I would say do not do it. But at the same time, as Nancy noted, I think we give recommendations. We don't just come out and say, this is our recommendation.
I'm not sure it makes anybody's job easier.
No.
I mean, I can see how that perception persists. But that doesn't mean it's not the right thing to do.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
Well, I know real quick in the past that I think it's been every few years Leanne would always ask the commission, do you want us to provide recommendations? And I thought the opinion always had been no, I think the way we're doing it is fine. So I know that she tried to bring it up every so often, and I can continue to do that, but maybe it's in a discussion we can have at another point in time with both the commission.
Maybe it's the
it might have been
what you're doing now, right? You give us usually three or four different alternatives.
Yeah.
And just identify what the staff's preferred alternative is.
Yep.
Right.
And that would work, you know, just speaking for myself, I think you guys have a lot more opportunity to discuss these things than we do. I think we can take the time to discuss them, but typically our agenda comes out on Friday at noon, and for the most part, I don't know about you guys, but I don't know what's going to be on there unless somebody specifically asked me about something that's going to go on the agenda. So at Friday at noon is when I see something. And I know at 10 o'clock the following Tuesday is when I'm expected to make a decision on it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, you know, it's that, you know, that's not the only thing on the agenda. So if I know that the staff has made a recommendation to the commission about it, then whether you guys are all in, you know, in lockstep or not, you know, and I think it would give me another avenue, you know, of something to consider if, you know, I knew that the development staff made the recommendation to the commission, and like you say, then you know you can recommend whatever alternative you want when it. You know.
I think what you said
we
again,
can always
the
make
development
it
staff yeah. made recommendations to the commission.
Yeah.
Like when? When did this?
Well,
time
well,
when did this occur?
9 years ago.
Oh yeah, I was referring to the couple times where we've had this issue. I can recall in one situation we ended up referring it back simply because we had a staff recommendation and we had a commission recommendation, and we at the board wasn't really comfortable at that meeting to decide exactly which way to go. And so it was referred back, you know, and then a consensus did come back to us. But and that was just, you know,
okay.
a rare occasion.
Are we
it was
talking
probably
about recommendations from them to us?
Yes.
Or recommendations separate two separate recommendations.
I'm suggesting that in a staff report, most places, I think I just heard you say almost every place, gives you the staff report, and it includes staff recommends, doesn't tie you to anything. It allows you to go whatever direction you want to go. But I think it's another tool for us as supervisors to see, because I'll tell you where I'm going to really sit up and take notice. I'm going to read these things. I'm going to see what I think. But if I see staff recommend something and you guys go with it, I'm going to feel a lot more comfortable if that's the way I'm seeing it too. If they recommend something and you go a different direction, I'm going to go, well, wait a minute. I want to understand what this
occurred.
Is,
what
and I just,
exactly.
I think it's always helpful when you have your professional staff tell you what they think the proper course is,
right.
And then you guys are here to make sure from a citizen perspective that that's the proper course. And then we're here to follow that up as elected officials. That's just my, you guys need to operate, you're doing a great job, you need to operate however you're comfortable. It's just something that has always made me scratch my head that you guys were not getting recommendations.
See, I wasn't missing that because, like I said, we ask you, but, you know,
yeah.
And you do.
Yep.
But if you know, I don't see a problem with formalizing that in that within the presentation and the paperwork that we get to review ahead of time, that you say, based upon our research and so on, this is what we would recommend for you to consider.
Yeah. I and again, from my standpoint, I don't think I have a problem at all offering a recommendation. I'm looking at Ryan real quick to make sure that he kind of agrees with that too. It's not that difficult for us to do in the back of our heads. We might not put it in a staff report, but trust me, we all talk about it downstairs, and
absolutely.
We have a recommendation that we feel one way should go. And
right.
Absolutely.
Right.
I do have a request to the Board of Supervisors, though, that if the staff starts making their recommendation a little more official in the staff report, and you get an issue before you where the staff didn't necessarily agree with our recommendation, that you not just remand it back to us, hoping it comes back with consensus, that you give
right.
us specific direction as to what your concerns are, where
oh, yeah,
you'd like,
exactly.
what you'd like
and
to
that,
be
yeah.
explored more
right.
thoroughly.
Exactly, and that's the way we,
yeah.
we well, and, in this case.
Yeah, one of the beauties of this board is we are not, we're not big fans of sending things back for further study. I mean, we try to get to a decision. So the way I would suggest from the three of us, you're going to get something back, is if there's something that we're just not clear on, mm-hmm. that we want to make sure that we're not making a decision based on information that you guys never got to consider.
Right.
I think that's about
yeah. And I don't know where the commission, where you're at in this. We can discuss this at a future meeting to see, kind of engage your input on how you want us to move forward with that. I have no problem with it, but if you all would like to see recommendations in the staff reports, we'll go there. So.
Mm-hmm. Good.
You want to add that to tonight's agenda?
You can amend it if you want.
You can amend it.
You can amend it.
You can do that.
We can amend it.
The question or comment that I have is related to the a little bit to the ordinance one of the public hearings and also the public perception, and it goes back to my involvement originally with the wind farm coming in. We got our letter from the county at the board meeting on a Thursday, and the meeting was on Monday, and you know, we called and we looked at the website, but I wasn't able to find. I didn't look in the right place. So we came to that information, that meeting, for information purposes, and then I had time to prepare for the second meeting, the Board of Adjustment. It seems that if we had a scaled process where, you know, if somebody's building a new Morton building or a grain bin, they don't need any more notice than they're getting necessarily because, you know, it's their neighbor. But if there's an industrial complex going up next to you, the perception at that meeting was that the manufacturers had a huge head start on the neighbors. We didn't know anything about it, and so we didn't have any time to prepare and do research. And later, when I did do the research, I found that a lot of the objections that were raised had been addressed in the process, but we didn't know that. So what I would think would be a good idea is when those big industrial concerns come to the county, if there could be a 30 or a 60-day notice where they're required to send letters to the neighbors so people have more time to think about it and to, you know, not come to the meeting and be all upset because it seems like everything's been decided already and And I don't have any input now because, you know, they've got a document this big that they've prepared. So that would be my thought, is if we could let people know sooner on those big developments.
Okay, just tell me the line. What's the line? So you told me that a Morton building or something like that doesn't count, and clearly a wind turbine does.
Yeah.
Give me the line between those two.
That's where I was hoping that staff or someone else with more experience, you know, somebody building a Morton building is not going to come to the county a month in advance necessarily, or maybe they are, you know, as they start to go forward. But a wind farm or an ethanol plant, they're doing 6 months, a year of planning. And at some point, they contact the county to find out, what do I need to do to get onto the board meeting? You know, what are the deadlines? What do I need to do? Seems like maybe first contact or something is when they should be given. Okay, if you want to get on the January meeting, you need to send letters to the neighbors 30 days in advance of that meeting.
Now, I'm actually really intrigued. So we have a current process with CAFOs where if somebody comes forward and files the master matrix, that triggers the county notifying every landowner within two miles. I actually really like the idea of somebody other than the county paying for that, namely whoever is filing. Nancy, I'd be interested to get your take on that. Would that have been onerous for you guys? So when you started to do your expansion right there, I think we'd notified everybody within 2 miles for that one, didn't we? Would that have been too onerous on you and Bill if part of the county requirement would have been, okay, we're going down this process, we'll get, you know, 30 days down the road, we'll start to look at it, we need to make sure everybody's notified, and that's part of what you as the person doing something is responsible for.
Well, if you had help knowing exactly who was in there.
Who was in there.
Well, I'm thinking that we would do it, but
I think that's why the county owns that, right? Because the county would then have that responsibility to make sure that they could identify the right people and then ensure that it
gets done. Absolutely. But I'm looking at it more as a fee kind of thing, not asking you to stuff envelopes to get it done, but more as part of the filing fee as you guys go through and look at your fee structure. Is there a possibility of requiring something like this? And, you know, this is the fee for us to do that.
First of all, we notify property owners within a quarter mile. The way we have done that, and we use GIS to find all those addresses and whatnot. How we do that currently is our legal notices, usually for public hearing items, are published in the paper. We try to send out those letters usually a day before they're published in the paper, so the two work together. Then we go back to that no less than 4 day thing, and that's usually when we're hitting publications is what, 4, 5, 6 days before the meeting typically, and that's when we're sending those notifications out. We can change that. I don't think that would be an issue at all. We could probably send those out much sooner. The calendar that the board or the Planning and Zoning Commission is going to look at tonight sets our meeting, our deadlines for applications 2 weeks before the meeting, and that's for us. That's about how much time we need. So, you know, technically we could probably send out notices to property owners 2 weeks ahead of time. I don't think that would be an issue. Now, going back to the filing fee portion of it, actually up until last year, we used to charge applicants a fee based off how many letters we'd send out. So part of the application fee, we'd bring it in, look at the property, see how many letters we had to send it to, and then charge them postage on top of their filing fee. What we did is Leanne, when she was director, kind of went back the last 3 years and got an average application cost of what that was, and now we just do a flat fee based off what that average application cost was. So it was actually a lot of work for us to, you know, people would call in and say, okay, well, I need to figure out how much I have to pay. Well, previously we had a base fee, and then for a subdivision, you had to pay $10 per lot that you're creating. We charge 25 cents per acre of land that you were including in an application, and then we did postage. So for us, it was so much work just to calculate the fee that personally I like having that flat fee much better now, and I think that flat fee is covering those costs. So
Every so often, you know, Rose Prairie, for example, when that was going through the process, when you send those letters within a quarter mile, we were probably sending out 200 letters because you're so close to Ames, where you're so dense inside the city of Ames that you're sending out letters. And the good thing is when you're out in the middle of a county, you're sending quarter mile. But for the most part, you know, people own multiple parcels out there, so really we're only sending out about three letters, which helps. But again, you get down there, you get, you know, 300 some letters, and that becomes a little bit expensive. But again, I think we've averaged in all that cost to figure out an appropriate cost to counter.
But your responsibility to send them, because I think we had this discussion when we were talking about the CAFOs.
Mm-hmm.
Is it if there's a city that's within that 2 miles, do you send notice to everybody within the city? Or do you send notice to the city?
No, we send every parcel. So if the parcels land inside the city, the people inside the city get it. But we also send something to the city to let them know. And our hope is that they post it at City Hall, so anybody coming into City Hall can also see it and that right. stuff too. So
all cities within 2 miles.
Yep. Yep.
Not just the quarter mile.
Yep. So you know, there's a lot of stuff that we see between Gilbert and Ames, and Gilbert and Ames both get notified about it.
Oh. I don't want to dig too deep into this because I think the idea here is to put ideas out there that we need to find solutions to later on. But I wonder if, you know, do you require conceptual review for conditional use permit applications?
Yep, we have conceptual review for just about everything other than agricultural subdivisions and those residential parcel subdivisions. You don't see those anymore. The board
right.
sees those. There's not conceptual review for those. That's typically our first bat around with it. You know, you talk about the wind farms. They put a lot of work in front of that. Well, we don't really see it much more or much before the public sees it, maybe a month or two before the public's actually notified about it. But still, yeah, we could probably do a better job.
Mr. Sanders asked, what's the line? And it seems to me that the zoning code contains a line, and that's if a conditional use permit is required, then we've already identified that use as being unique enough per application and per site that it needs its own review. They also come in for a conceptual review before they even officially apply. So it seems to me that those things, maybe some notice when somebody has a conceptual review for that. I'm not saying mailing necessarily, but perhaps there's some portion of the website that is dedicated
that.
To that. Oh, you do?
Yes, yes. Our website, if you've ever gone to it, you can sign up for what's called the Notify Me portion of it. You can put your email address in there, and you can choose what you get notified. Our conceptual review, interagency review.
And the topics on conceptual review and the locations of the properties are included in that. Maybe there's just a better way to get that information out, other than I don't want to create a new process.
But what's... Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think, Scott, what you may have been referring to in terms of the industrial things coming up, you said ethanol plant, okay? I think that one of the problems that we need to talk about is, if, for instance, those ethanol plants that are right in your neighborhood are part of Nevada, which do not come to us.
The original plan, there was zoning. We got notices when the zoning was changed.
From
the annexation happened.
But it didn't really say what it was going to be used for.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
At all. And so that's a whole different issue. But then when they decided they were going to put Lincoln Way Energy and then they were going to put DuPont there, that was out of our bailiwick. We didn't have anything to say about it.
Our SPO letters right now, they're very form letters. So pretty much what happens is Kristen enters some stuff into a database. The database imports it into a letter. We send out the letter. We had that Johnson Agricultural Subdivision that the board just reviewed this week, and the word development was in the SPO. Every property owner that called us was going, what's going on out here? My gosh, you know. And once we tell them what's going on, they're like, well, it says development. That's not development. So internally we've talked about changing our SPO letter a little bit, and maybe we can start having our SPO letter be a little bit more unique to the project when we're sending that out and not more of a form letter. I don't know if that's too much of that's too much work for us to do really at all. But
you're either going to spend the time on creating a more informed letter or you're going to spend the time answering.
Or we're going to spend the time times seven answering the calls that we get in for it. That's a really good point, honestly.
Okay, this is a good time for me to jump in because actually one of my issues was this same issue, more on the advanced notification issue. Since I've been on the commission, the only criticisms I've gotten were from people who felt like they did not have enough time to get their ducks in a row to come to the commission and really state their case for or against. So I wanted to bring up, I for one didn't know what all the rules and regulations statewide were that would affect this, but I just wanted to bring that up to see if that was something we wanted to look at, and so it tags right on.
And Story County goes above and beyond what state code requires. I'm not even sure state code requires any public notification other than posting an agenda 24 hours, or if you're having a public hearing, the no more than whatever that is. But I know a lot of, when I talk to a lot of zoning people, there's some people who believe that there's a requirement to notify within like 500 feet. I've never once personally saw that in state code. I don't know if it's there, but I've never really looked into it too hard because we do above and beyond that anyways. So.
The only other thing I'd add to that is that I think we should include in that what we come up with in looking at ordinance number one and publishing differently, or I don't know if there's a way better than mailings or not, but we could certainly keep that in mind.
I would love to be able to have everybody's email address in this county. That would save us a lot of work. I've always kind of joked about Renee with that, and when she sends the tax statements out, to try to get people's email address and get them into the database somewhere, because that would be really helpful. That's a pipe dream.
We're a long ways from it.
Well, there's the issue.
But we can keep it in mind.
If it's a dead email, how do you know that you got it? So.
Very true.
Yeah, that's...
The only other issue I was going to bring up was Hickory Grove Trailer Park, so... We've covered that, so I'm fast.
Well, I wanted to ask, we're thinking about changing our start time,
mm-hmm.
and staff has asked us, you know, that would be better for them, and maybe if we started like at 4 o'clock. Well, it did seem to work with a lot of us, surprisingly, but what about the public being able to come at that time of day to be able to participate in these decisions? What do you think? Is that a good idea for us to go to 4 o'clock? Not so good.
Well,
okay, regarding what you just said in the public coming and so on, when these guys came on board 4 years ago, okay, they were very public-oriented, right?
And we still are.
Well, in one little team, we made another issue, okay, and that was you started having meetings twice a day, okay, on Tuesdays, so that it was more convenient for the public to come. Guess what? A lot of times there was nobody there. I mean, most of the time, I would say. I'd probably even say 90% of the time.
We're not doing them anymore. So
yeah, they quit doing them. Okay? Now, here's the thing. Okay, I'm retired. How many of you guys still have a 9-to-5 job? Raise your hand. Okay, so you made some concessions, some arrangements to be here. Am I correct? Well, guess what? If the public is going to be here, they can to talk to us. They can make the necessary arrangements. Also, that's the way I feel about it.
I think sometimes though, people lack that flexibility.
Yeah, as a nurse, I would not have been able to do that.
It's not that I'm going to ignore the reality that maybe they can, maybe they can't. I think that I just want to be mindful. I don't want to make the assumption that everybody can has the flexibility. If I am a citizen and I want to make honest feedback on something that I'm concerned about, and I work a shift job, and I'm going to lose pay, or I'm going to, my boss is not going to approve me being out, you have to take, then...
Remember, in every presentation that we get, in every we ask them, was there any public comment? So therefore, those folks that cannot make the necessary concessions, which is going to be a few, only a few, then they can certainly call and or email and or send a postal letter.
Right. I'm not arguing against our 4th.
What do you guys think?
I like it.
I've always kind of thought that if even with you guys more than us, if there's a specific item on that agenda that you're interested in, you're going to make the arrangements to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you're looking to get something approved. If you want approval from the Planning and Zoning Commission on a project, you're going to make the time to get there. If you're an interested citizen and you want to hear what's going on, you know, that
right. I'm less concerned about the people that are presenting because, yes, they have a very vested interest. I'm
right.
more concerned about the affected parties, right, people
yeah.
that may or may not be impacted.
And I don't know what you guys get for interested people just coming to hear what you guys are doing.
We don't get a lot.
It doesn't happen.
You know,
have you
not when it's not election season.
Exactly. You know, they'll drop off dramatically, you know, next week.
Here. In addition to the presentation?
Correct. I think if it's only, I think they've all had a vested interest.
I tell my husband they're coming to see me. But that's the truth. Honestly.
We changed the Board of Health meetings when shortly after I started. As a chair, they used to meet at, was it 4 o'clock?
Yeah,
because Kristen whined about it enough because she didn't want to have to work overtime, so we changed it to 2 o'clock, and yeah, nobody had any problems with that, so. Yeah.
That's true. Couple thoughts.
Is it true?
It's true.
Okay.
People had told me very seldom are there any public here, and so I was amazed. But since I have been on the board, there has never been a meeting.
Well, it must have been consistently hot issues since you've been on.
We're committed. So when we did away with evening meetings, so there weren't evening meetings when Paul and I joined the board, and we put them in, and it looked a lot like this at all of our evening meetings. And so we had trouble reconciling paying the overtime and everything else to get it done. But the commitment we made is, If there's a topic, if there's an issue that is demanding more public input, more attention, we'll have a special meeting. In one case, we had a special meeting down in Collins. Because it was a Collins issue. We went down there, was it 7 o'clock at night one night
like to that.
Have a public meeting? And I'd say we'll stay absolutely committed to that. I think it's completely appropriate if you guys want to move up to a 4 p.m. And we just need to continue to grow our public outreach. It's one of the reasons that Leanne has moved to where she is. We need to continue to grow our public outreach and make sure that there's plenty of opportunity for people to give feedback without sitting right here and coming up to the microphone to give you guys feedback. And if we can do that, if we can reach out and we see an issue that is demanding a lot of public input, then we need to look at a special meeting at a time that we can get, and probably more for the Board of Supervisors than for you guys, that we can really get that input. So I'd encourage you, if it works for the commission, to go to 4 o'clock. I don't think that puts any undue hardship. I'm always intrigued. We're not a 9-to-5 world anymore. I mean, we are, first of all, most of us are always working if you're connected at all through technology. And the second one is, it's always kind of been ironic to me, if you want to have a 5:30 or 6 o'clock, you worked second shift a lot of your life, didn't you? I mean, what about those people?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I do have a few issues.
I couldn't think of
darn thing. I they're not going to be easy sales, but I would like to visit the 35-acre minimum lot size in the A1 district. It is an ag preservation tool, but I believe it undersells the value of scattered acreages in rural Story County. That value being a conservation value in that they are the only islands of habitat in a monotony of corn and beans in Story County. So they provide habitat to wildlife. They provide just simple variability out on the landscape. They do some filtering of runoff and some infiltration of stormwater. And they provide a housing opportunity for folks that is sometimes in demand. And sometimes I wonder if we would not have done all these years just as good a job of preserving ag land if we had a prohibition against rural subdivision rather than a standard that essentially prohibited scattered acreages too. So I don't know if there's a way to incorporate more allowance for scattered acreages under the 35-acre minimum lot size, broaden the list of exceptions. I know there's the farmstead exception where you can divide off an old farmstead. That only applies if the remnants of the farmstead are there still and it's not been converted back to ag land. If there's one thing we should have learned over the last 10 years, it's that a farmstead or a farm grove or an old house is not a hindrance to conversion to ag land if corn prices and soybean prices are what we want them to be. So I don't see that development and that you can call that development. A rural subdivision that has infrastructure, that's a different deal.
What did we do? We addressed that here a couple years ago.
So we implemented that residential parcel subdivision. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not.
Okay, so the residential parcel subdivision more or less said if you have a dwelling in existence at this time, it's not a farmstead, anything, as long as your property card shows that there is a dwelling on the property, you can subdivide that dwelling off, and the remaining portion of whatever that parcel was becomes buildable. So it offered an opportunity to have a second house close to where there already was an existing house, and our remnants of a farmstead counted as well, too. So,
okay, but you still could not go five acres out of a farm field.
Yeah, exactly. It didn't fix that problem. It didn't say you can't still plopping a house down in the middle of a farm field is impossible in a lot of areas.
Yeah. Well, a little more reasoning for that. One, I think that the 35-acre minimum lot size preserves ag land for a certain type of agriculture. And we're seeing a food and farm and agriculture movement now that the Story County can't really accommodate. What we're talking about, small produce farms, small livestock farms, these folks are not going to be able to afford 35 acres, nor could they immediately put 35 acres into production in the production model that they're using, low mechanization, lots of hand labor, more varied crops. And I'd like to see that accommodated. Also, you of course have the ag land or the ag exemption in the state of Iowa, but I'm not. These types of acreages and farms kind of teeter on the definition a little bit of farm or not farm, and what happens when I want to resell 5 acres.
That's and jumping in on the agricultural exemption, that's always been one of my biggest issues with it. Is okay, you can tell me that you're farming and you want to have a house on 3 acres. But then when you go to sell it, you have to understand that you have to sell it to another farmer, and that farmer is going to have to sell it to another farmer, and that so down the road. And does that happen? Probably not. I'm sure there's a lot of examples where the agricultural exemption has been used. 3 years later, they sell their house, and that person living in it is no longer farming. It's hard for us to track that.
Right.
I mean, but it's probably happening.
We're way, way below the historic level of the number of homes in the country right now. And, a rural subdivision has a different character than the type of thing that I'm talking about. On a related...
I grew up in California, so I need more explanation about exactly kind of what you're talking about.
Sure.
I mean, what is it that you're looking to encourage?
I would like to secure the opportunity for someone to buy a small acreage to live on and or to farm on.
So if I wanted to buy 5 acres on the edge of Ames and plant a 3-acre garden, and I'll call it a garden, you'd call it farming, or put a couple of sheep or goats or whatever.
Right. I don't even necessarily think that we need to limit it to agricultural production. I think that we have far fewer acreages than we had 50 years ago. And we could return to a level closer to that without violating any of our priorities for ag land preservation. And in fact, we could do great things, or better things at least, from a conservation perspective.
The A1 zoning district encompasses over 98% of ground in rural Story County right now. I ran that not too long ago, so I know that. In the A1 district, we say you have to have at least 35 acres to build a house. We subject that to now 4 exceptions. One exception is if that lot at the time it was created, the zoning regulations at the time that that lot was created would have allowed for a house to be built there, you can have a house built there. That more or less grandfathers in existing lots. Second one states that if there is a farmstead there, you can have it on less than 1 acre. Farmstead is defined as a combination of farm dwellings, farm barns, windbreaks, all that stuff. And if there's not currently even a house on that farmstead, you can reestablish. You can tear the old house down, build a new one. The other one is our Lisa exception. LISA, it's an acronym for Land Evaluation and Site Assessment. What that does is it takes various aspects, gives a score to that particular piece of ground. If that score is low enough, meaning that that piece of ground has low agricultural viability, we'll say instead of that 35-acre minimum, you can have 1-acre minimum because we don't see it to be productive as ag. All that 35-acre minimum was put in place in 1977 to preserve farm ground. That was its main intention. And I think what Aaron's saying is that I think through the years, and not that I don't disagree with him, but I think through the years, a lot of that has kind of, I think ag ground's going to preserve itself with prices even currently right now when you have corn and soybean prices and whatnot. We're seeing houses, old farmsteads. You have a lot of corporate farms out there that are buying up some of these grounds where there's a farmstead. They're just plowing the house over and planting it in row crops. So knowing that, can we – yeah, I don't know what the answer is, but I think
– is your point, because it's 35 acres, right, you'd have to be a developer in order to buy the, you know, $500,000
– Well, or you have to be a very large or large-scale farmer in order to buy land in those tracts. Right.
35 acres, you mean.
35 acres,
yeah, buying
right.
A minimum of 35 acres and,
right.
You know, $12,000 an acre and, you know, I'm ballparking, but –
Right.
You know, or you could be that landowner and say, you know, I want to keep it as farmland, but I want to divest some of it, and I'd sell 5-acre house/farm lots, right? I mean, is that...
Probably a 5-acre, because I think what's important here is the scattered sense of acreages that is historic to Story County and to much of Iowa.
In a positive manner or a negative?
In a positive way, I think that's positive. I think that we've done a great job with the 35-acre minimum lot size of preserving farmland, but we have preserved it for only one type of agriculture and made it inaccessible to other types of agriculture and inaccessible to people who just want to live in the country.
You're saying more we've preserved it for corporate farms and we're not attracting small-scale farms.
Well, for large-scale farms, yeah. However you want to label those. But.
Two questions. Maybe more thoughts than questions. First one is, seems like when we looked at this 35-acre and we came up minimum and came up with at least one new exception that we put in. Was it one or two that we put in?
Just one.
Just one new exception that we put in. That I was really, really surprised by how many buildable sites of less than 35 acres there were in Story County. It seems like you and Leanne had a screenshot for us where you showed us every buildable site that's out there in Story County under our current rules, and there were, I mean, lots and lots and lots of them that aren't built on right now, and maybe we need to do a better job making that information available, because I think there is, in fact, an opportunity for somebody to do exactly what you're suggesting under our current rules. Second one is, specifically, we just had a young guy named Eric Peterson. He came to us a year or so ago, and we found a way for him to build. It seems like it's just in, is it far north, northwest?
Just northwest of Roland.
Just northwest of Roland. How did we find a way for him to build?
That was, the Payer Farm. Jane Payer, I think was her name, owned 160 acres. He wanted to just buy 18 acres was it to build the house?
It was less than 35.
Yeah.
That's what I remember about it.
Yep. So what happened here was, you know, we told him, no, you can't build a house there initially. We had some meetings with him. What we decided to do was kind of back in to that residential parcel subdivision. So he first started with an agricultural subdivision where he got a lot that was 35 acres in size. He's actually building a house right now. They're doing the foundation. I was on my way back from Mason City when I did the inspection on that. So
he bought the 35 acres,
but then he turned
around and he sold X number of acres.
He hasn't
back.
Done that yet. He's got to build the house. And with the residential parcel subdivision, we say as long as there's a house there, you can split that off on a minimum of 1 acre and the remainder will come buildable. So he bought the 35, he's going to build the house, now come back again and do a residential parcel subdivision to get his 18 acres for the house. I don't believe intends on making the second parcel buildable, but it was a way for him to get on something smaller than the 35 acres. It it personally kind of went against the intent, I think, of what we have out there for the 35-acre minimum and the residential parcel subdivision. But at the same time, we were assured throughout the process that, in the end, we're only going to have one house out there on that 160 acres. So really, the intent of meeting that 35-acre minimum was still there.
Well, and my point with that, Aaron, was simply that we've got a mechanism, and I think we're really, really receptive to doing exactly what you're talking about doing. I don't think we view our rules as prohibiting us from doing what makes sense for a rural kind of community. We like the idea of the small scattered houses, but not the rural subdivisions, with the caveat that there are some places that the highest and best use of ground, at least in my mind, is some kind of rural subdivision. And so all I was trying to get to there is, seems to me we have a mechanism now to do exactly what you're talking about doing.
But did you just see how long it took to explain that mechanism? And then you also have the issue of choice. You know,
process.
Right.
You had to buy the 35 first and then go, you know, do it ask that.
And there's a process in place, but I think Eric would probably tell you this too, is that there was a lot of paperwork that needed to be done. They needed to put the agreements in place to do all that stuff. So, I mean, yeah, it's there, but it's probably not the best process in the world.
So I would just suggest if that's the intent, if that's where we want to be, then let's just get there and make it as straightforward as we can.
I think you're going to see more and more interest. 12, 15 years ago, the interest was, where can I have my rural estate on a paved road? I think the emphasis is going to switch. Where can I buy my acreage where I can also retire from my corporate job, start this little organic farm I had in mind and sell in the farmer's market on Saturday? I think you're going to see more and more interest in that. Kind of leads me to my next one. I don't want to monopolize the time here, but I think that Story County should consider looking at your accessory building standards, but in particular, I think you should consider accessory dwellings. Demographically, we have an aging population with a big bulge on the front end of it. People who will be needing in 20, 30 years, going to be 15 years maybe, going to be needing long-term care, live close to relatives. Right now, I think Story County will allow a temporary mobile home to be placed on a property so that you can care for a infirmed individual. Well, now we're putting up temporary mobile homes everywhere, and you guys have to track it administratively. Why not allow a accessory dwelling that is clearly subordinate to the principal dwelling that will add value to these properties instead of become a potential problem down the road? I just think you can see more and more demand for that. That kind of ties back to this agricultural movement, small-scale agricultural and food movement, where these farms rely less on mechanization. They need people. They can't afford people oftentimes, but they could provide them with room and board or some partial room and board. That's going to be a harder sell than the first one. I understand that, but people are not going to love the idea of everybody putting up a rental unit next to their farmhouse. But I think that it's something that's worthy of being explored. And then the last thing is, again, on a related note, I think you're going to see more and more agriculturally related businesses proposed in the county that stretch the intent of the retail and novelty farms conditional use permit, as expertly crafted as that little piece of policy is.
I like doing things. Was that you?
Yeah, that was me. I think you're going to see more and more things like we process our own chickens on the farm and put them in the freezer, and then you can come buy them from our farm store. Not so much walk through our corn maze, but come and participate in real agricultural commerce here. You know, what impact is that going to cause for the county down the road? That's a little more open-ended than the other things I had in mind. I don't have a specific goal in mind. I just think it's going to be something we'll need to look at. So.
Then you get the food inspectors involved.
It gets complicated, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can't even make cookies in your kitchen and sell them out of your kitchen.
Ryan, you might know a little bit on this. Where are we on the whole local foods thing? Because I know that probably ties into some of what you're even getting at, too. I don't know.
I'm not sure what
Yeah. What's that? The local food systems planning that we did, and I know we started that movement a while, and then it kind of lost some traction. I think Leanne's still kind of been pecking away at that every so often. But, yeah, I don't know, and the board might know this probably more even than us. I'm not sure where we are on that whole thing, because that could maybe tie into the whole 35-acre minimum, all that stuff too. So, but, you know, that's a good point. Maybe we could look at some further exceptions to it. I'm not sure it would be a good idea to just abolish the 35-acre minimum necessarily, and I'm not sure that's what you're trying to get at either. But I think maybe even looking at it, we're one of a few counties I know that have 35-acre minimum. Linn County is the other one that I can think of off the top of my head, but a lot of them are much less than 35 acres. And I know Dubuque County is, 5-10 or something like that, and they also have a much higher rural population than Surrey County does, too. So.
I guess to recap this as succinctly as possible, if the threat to preservation of our best ag land is large residential subdivisions in the A1 zone, an area unzoned and unplanned for residential subdivisions, then let's make the policy to oppose residential subdivisions in those areas.
We had one come up. I want to say March or April, we had the 40-house development that's up.
Cameron Estates.
Yeah.
That was good, viable farmland, was existing farmland.
80 acres.
But it was 80 acres.
But with,
and if you could only sell it off as two parcels to...
But that area had already been planned for residential development. Yes. It was in a residential plan designation. Right. That would be the distinction. Yeah.
And again, I think you're getting out in the areas where you're not within 2 miles of a city. You know, you can walk or drive down a mile of road, and there's maybe one house there, if even that. So,
is a farmstead every 40 or 80 acres a threat to ag land preservation? I guess that's the question.
That's enough for me. Sorry.
That was good.
It was good.
Nope.
Well, that's why he had a list.
We really appreciate your time. We know how valuable it is, and you gave us a lot of it.
We've
been a lot of really good discussion,
We appreciate what you guys did. This is a really good thing that Charlie asked for, and I think we should plan on doing it regularly.
I appreciate all your input and help, because this was good. Yeah, we'll be able to hopefully draw up some great ideas, and we'll present them at your next meeting. I think my next departmental report is mid-December, so hopefully I'll have it by then, and I'll let you guys kind of know where we're at on that. So,
super. Sounds good.
All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.